Word on Health with Paul Pennington.
For your very best of health.
Scabies is a highly contagious condition caused by mites that results in an itchy rash. It's spread through close skin contact, and it should be treated quickly to stop it spreading. According to a report by the Guardian newspaper and the British Association of Dermatologists, scabies cases are surging, posing, it's claimed, a potential major public health threat. Dr. Tess McPherson is from the British Association of Dermatologists.
There are various reasons, I think, that are contributing to this at the moment. There are more cases in various groups of people, particularly young people, anyone that lives in crowded accommodation. There's a general lack of public knowledge about the condition. So that means that people don't know they've got scabies. They don't even consider it as a potential diagnosis. And that can also be among health workers and pharmacists as well. So people are not being diagnosed maybe appropriately. There's been quite a lot of access issues with some of the most commonly used treatments. That includes topical treatments. And also there's a tablet for particular forms of scabies, which has also been more difficult to get for certain populations. And even if you get the treatments, then people don't always use them effectively and correctly. If you don't leave them in contact with your skin for long enough, if you don't reapply them after you've washed, these are all things why there can be treatment failure. The last thing which we're not really sure about is whether there might be some tolerance to treatments for some of the mites. So treatments not being as effective as they previously have been to eliminate mites in some people.
There are a number of myths and misunderstandings about scabies.
Importantly, anyone can get it. It's not something that's confined to particular people or being dirty or living a bad life. It's just something which is very contagious, and it's been with humans since records began. The really important thing is with scabies is you have to treat not just yourself, but anyone that you have that potentially be in skin-to-skin contact with you. And that can be quite a lot of people. So if they're not all treated, then it's very easy to get reinfested. Even if you treat yourself, if people around you are not treating, then the scabies continues to transmit between groups.
Given the lack of understanding of how scabies may manifest itself, what should we be looking out for?
Any itchy rash, essentially, can be scabies. Particularly itchy at night, when you get warm. The skin rash can be quite nonspecific. Particular features of scabies are little spots in warm areas, in between the fingers and the genitals, in between the toes, then that's something to consider. But if you or others around you have an itchy rash, then you should definitely consider whether you might have scabies or not.
If we suspect an outbreak of scabies, should we approach our pharmacist or the GP?
Certainly, if you know that you've been in contact with scabies, you have an itchy rash, you have any concerns, then you can go to pharmacies. The important things we've been trying to educate people on is actually the product information. We think treatment needs to be applied for at least 12 hours. Some of the treatments, even if you get them, are not being applied correctly, not being applied to all of the skin that needs to be applied. And as we've mentioned, not treating contacts appropriately. Certainly, itch can continue for a week or two after treatment. If things are persisting, then that's probably a time to get some help from a health professional.
My grateful thanks to Dr. Tess McPherson. For more information and to link through to the British Association of Dermatologists, visit our website, wordonhealth.com. That's wordonhealth.com.
Word on Health, for your very best of health.
Across the UK, there are over 30,000 out-of-hospital cardiac arrests, or heart attacks as they're otherwise known, that take place each year. But sadly, less than 1 in 10 people survive. Acting fast when faced with what's been termed the ultimate medical emergency is crucial. To enable us to do so, as part of Heart Month, the British Heart Foundation is offering free CPR training that, armed with a smartphone or tablet, we can learn in just 15 minutes. Lizzie Moscardini is the British Heart Foundation's Programme Manager for Health Partnerships and Community Resuscitation.
CPR stands for cardiopulmonary resuscitation and is a life-saving skill that everyone should learn because it could be the difference between life or death. It's something that we should administer when someone goes into cardiac arrest. It helps the body continue to pump blood around the body to give people the best possible chance of survival.
Lizzie, how many people across the UK don't know CPR skills?
Previous surveys have shown us that around a third of adults have never undertaken any form of CPR training, and we know that bystander intervention is really key to helping the chain of survival, so it's really important that more people do learn how to do CPR. We know in other countries where CPR is taught from a young age, the survival rates are better than they are here. So we want to make sure that everyone in the UK has the opportunity to learn these skills because it could make a difference in the ultimate medical emergency.
Talk me through what you're offering via the British Heart Foundation website.
Reviver is our free, innovative online training tool that we're encouraging everyone to use. It's been created to improve the nation's CPR and defibrillation skills. The training's really quick. It's really easy. All you need is a smartphone and a cushion. And in 15 minutes, the training tool will take you through how to recognize a cardiac arrest. It will give you feedback on chest compressions so you can practice those live. And then it also outlines the correct steps to take for using a defibrillator. So Reviver can really help give anyone the confidence to step in and help save a life.
My grateful thanks to Lizzie Muscadini. To connect through to the free online CPR training that the British Heart Foundation are offering, which I actively encourage you to do, log on to our wordonhealth.com website. That's wordonhealth.com.
Word on Health, on air and online 52 weeks of the year.
As we live through what was deemed by a travel company as the most depressing time of the year, one organisation, for the past 8 years, has been encouraging us to turn the blues to red. Hannah Beecham, MBE, is CEO of Red January.
Red January is a nationwide public health movement that's empowering people to overcome the barriers around inactivity and lower well-being in the winter. There is so much evidence out there to show that as a nation, we are much less active in the winter, and there's more reports of lower mood, lower energy. If you experience mental health challenges, your symptoms can increase.
So, Hannah, practically, how does it work?
We're here to help boost your motivation to move, to connect at a time of year when you might be isolated. You sign up for free as an individual or as a team at join.redjanuary.com. And we encourage you to set a personal challenge that works for you and your lifestyle. So we've seen thousands of people across the country embrace movement in different ways, starting with a four-year-old called Jack, who is taking part with his school, and they're enjoying doing laps around their playground every morning, to a 98-year-old Brenda, who's out there walking her dog and has set up a WhatsApp group with her family. So she's still got that connection and accountability as well each day. We've seen people embrace things like cold water swimming, rekindling team sports that they used to enjoy as a child, like netball and football, and also using it as an opportunity to train for another goal, perhaps throughout the year, like a running challenge. It really is whatever works for people's lifestyle.
What was your motivation in setting up Red January?
My mum experiences depression, and she was going through particularly low periods in the winter time. And it got me thinking about what was out there for my mum and for all of us at this time of year, because whether you experience mental health challenges or not, we all experience the dark and the cold days during the winter, and it can have an impact just generally on our mood and energy. There really wasn't anything out there that was giving us a positive goal to move and connect. And it got me thinking about beating the winter blues, what that could look like. So Red January started with me and my mum moving in a way that worked for her. And it took a while to kind of create and start building those small habits. But throughout the month, my mum built up enough self-esteem, confidence to take that first step outdoors. And the difference on our mental health, even to this day, knowing that now she can turn to movement, is just incredible. 8 years on, got over 270,000 people out there embracing movement in a way that works for them and their lifestyle.
At the turn of the year, many of us make a resolution to exercise more, but fail. How is Red January different?
We're encouraging people to create real change, not necessarily New Year's resolutions. What we find as part of Red, and we've seen this with the research that we've been doing with the University of Oxford, is that when people start small and realistic with their movement habits, they'll be more likely to continue them well beyond January. And again, what that looks like practically is things like people leaving their car at home and walking their children to school, getting off the bus to stop earlier and walking the rest of the way. It might seem small and kind of incremental, but the difference that it will make to your life day in, day out on your well-being, mental health is absolutely huge.
Beyond boosting mood, fitness and bringing people together, I understand your community is making a wider impact.
Over £3 million has been raised for movement and mental health projects around the UK. And this year, those projects are being led by Mental Health UK and by the National Academy for Social Prescribing. So where it's fitting, people will be recommended movement in their own local community through walking clubs, running clubs, swimming clubs, whatever, again, works for that individual. And we couldn't be prouder that year round, there's projects out there being funded by Redders Challenge, Redders Movement. It's just amazing to see.
My grateful thanks to Hannah Beecham. To find out more and to connect through to Red January, visit our wordonhealth.com website. That's wordonhealth.com.
Word on Health, for your very best of health.
Across the UK, 1.2 million people are affected by COPD, including me. COPD exacerbations account for 1 in 8 UK hospital admissions. It's thought that malnutrition affects 1 in 3 inpatients and 1 in 5 outpatients with COPD. This can develop gradually over several years or quickly with exacerbations. Low BMI and low muscle mass contribute to poorer outcomes. Appropriate nutrition, it's claimed, can make a difference. Consultant dietitian Anne Holdaway is from the Malnutrition Pathway.
We know it can affect the frequency of exacerbations. We know that if they're well nourished, they're less likely to go into hospital. And if they're well nourished and go into hospital, they're more likely to get home quicker than if they were undernourished. As COPD progresses, then symptoms such as breathlessness can become worse. And we know that breathlessness in particular can really impact on the enjoyment of food and eating and drinking. Symptoms like dry mouth that might be associated with the use of oxygen therapy can also make eating and drinking difficult. Poor nutrition, so not being able to eat and drink enough, can affect how well you can participate in everyday activities because it can affect your overall strength and well-being.
And how can someone with COPD identify that they are malnourished?
Monitoring weight and looking out for unplanned weight loss is probably the sort of two areas I would say that individuals with COPD should be on the lookout for. And equally for those who are caring for individuals with COPD is to know if there is any weight loss. And if you haven't got a set of scales at home and it's not easy to weigh yourself, then keeping an eye on how well your clothes fit or how your jewellery is fitting can be an indicator of the unplanned weight loss.
I understand you've recently chaired a panel of experts to update guidance for clinicians and patients on nutrition for COPD patients that's been endorsed by professional and patient organisations. What do you cover?
The Managing Malnutrition in COPD guidance was established to try and help healthcare professionals provide good nutritional advice at the earliest opportunity, so that nutrition is part of that holistic assessment. Many healthcare professionals, including doctors, don't receive nutrition training within their careers. So there's a straightforward step-by-step guide for the healthcare professionals to follow so they can implement that in practice. When patients are coming in for a review, they can be checking their weight and their body mass index and looking out for problems that might be interfering with intake. But what's also key within the resources is the patient materials. Self-management is becoming more and more crucial. The more you can do to help yourself by keeping a check on your weight, by thinking about the food on your plate, is it a balanced meal? If it's not a balanced meal, then look at the resources because they tell you how you can make your meal balanced, how you might need to increase your protein through selecting certain foods. Eating more protein can actually help with your muscle mass, your strength of your muscles, which in turn help keep your muscles strong, not only for physical activity, but also for breathing and also for fighting off infections so you don't get an exacerbation. There are specific resources and top tips for patients and their carers about how you can adjust your diet to make up for any dietary deficit that may be arising because of that poor appetite or the inability to eat and drink as normal.
My grateful thanks to Anne Holdaway. To find out more and link through to the Malnutrition Pathway, to access the guidance on COPD and nutrition, visit our website, wordonhealth.com. That's wordonhealth.com.
Keeping you in touch with the health and lifestyle issues that matter. This is Word on Health with Paul Pennington.